This is Legal Luminaries. Join us as we delve into the inspiring stories of some of the greatest legal minds to have shaped South Africa's democracy and law. I'm Imandra Petty, your guide through the series.
Judge Albie Sachs is my guest today, a lawyer, an activist, a former judge of the Constitutional Court of South Africa. Judge Sachs has made important contributions to the legal framework in South Africa with his progressive judgments, including authoring the Constitutional Court's legalization of same-sex marriage in South Africa. It made ours the very first African country to do so. He was also an advocate for the concept of restorative justice, promoting the idea that justice should be aimed at healing and reconciliation, not just punishment. But we'll get to all of that later. Judge Sachs, thank you very much for your time and welcome to this podcast.
Okay, we normally call it each other Iman and Albie, and I'm really happy now. I'm not wearing my robes. I'm not saying all rise. This is now an elderly guy who's had a life. Actually, I can't believe my own life, to be quite candid. It's not the normal life of a judge. And being on a court that itself was quite extraordinary in very extraordinary times. So it's just kind of, it's more fables than storytelling, to be quite candid. But let's go.
Yeah, and I love that. So I've been given permission to be on a first name basis with Albie. Do you know, I realize you've been on the go quite a lot, Albie. What have you been up to in the last year?
Well, the big project is creating a collection that's called the Albie Collection. And that arose out of an award that Amal and George Clooney created for people who fight for justice against serious odds anywhere in the world, sort of on the line of the Oscars and the Emmys, and they call it the Albies. And I was the first recipient of it. So I said, okay, I feel a little bit ambivalent about the idea. You know, the pursuit of justice is always collective. It's never one individual standing out. Individuals make particular contributions, but there are huge teams involved and there are great traditions, and collegiality is absolutely central. And the idea of getting an award, I was the first recipient of the Albie myself, is a little bit contradicting my whole life in struggle. But, you know, that's the world we live in now, sad to say, and the lure of celebrity is as strong with me, a freedom fighter, as I think it is with most people. So then I said, well, okay, if people want to know who is this guy, Albie, can I make a library, a collection of my work so that people can understand why the name is being carried forward in that way? So got quite big money from Ford Foundation, and we're working on the Albie. But the idea is it could be the most boring thing on earth. Judges can be the most boring people on earth. It can be the most exciting thing on earth. If you somehow capture some of the tensions involved in the cases, some of the tensions that were on our court, the tensions in life, the tensions in getting the Constitution itself, it can be a fabulous story. So we're aiming at a story that is lyrical. We actually call it a conspectus. That's a word judges love using. On the conspectus of the evidence, I find that proof beyond reasonable doubt hasn't been established on the conspectus. So it's the conspectus of the life, love, law, literature, and laughter of Albie Sachs. I've got a great team working on it, and the idea is to make it for every person, everybody. And I don't even have a cell phone, let alone being somebody who inhabits the virtual world. But there am I suggesting this and that and the other. It's enormous fun. And we're hoping next to have some launches inside South Africa. It's already arranged in North America, maybe elsewhere in Africa as well, where I've been quite active in the past.
Oh, wow. I mean, how do I even dig into this amazing spread of what you've shared with us? And congratulations on the creation of this award. You know, it makes me think, Albie, you know, we always think of South Africa, country that's on the southern tip of Africa, the southernmost tip. And, you know, really globally, how do we stand out beyond, of course, our Mandela moment and our transformation moment. And it's so interesting when I think about the ICJ and the lead that the country's taken in pursuing the rights for Palestinians, when I think about the recognition that you've received now globally with this award and what an incredible repository it's going to be. And I'm hoping as well that with other future recipients, they also get the opportunity to be able to synthesize their work and commit that to that bigger repository for all the world to see. And it's inspired by a South African judge. So
yes, right on. But not just me, the court, you know, one of our most ardent supporters, a real kind of Mbongi in the United States, was the late judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Yeah. And I took her on a tour of the court and we had wonderful discussions. We went to Cape Town. She bought one of her most beautiful, she was famous for her collars. Her favorite, the one she wore the most often, she bought in a curio shop in Cape Town. Any event, she was a great believer in the Constitutional Court of South Africa. And when she was asked after Tahrir Square in Cairo, what advice will you give us Egyptians, that what can we learn from the American Constitution? She said, no, go to the South African Constitution. It's much more modern. It's more up to date. You can learn from that. A couple of years later, she did research in all the top English language apex courts in the world. Which jurisdictions did they borrow the most from? And she found the Canadian Supreme Court was quoted the most, and second was South Africa, way ahead of the United States, which used to be the leading, way ahead of the House of Lords, the Supreme Court in England, way ahead of Australia, New Zealand, Namibia, Kenya, India. India also has a very, very great court. So, and I've been told by judges on the European Court of Human Rights that they look to the South African Constitutional Court decision before any others. They don't necessarily quote it, but they believe this is a modern court dealing with modern issues in a modern way that's very humane, very empathetic, very well reasoned. So, you know, it's an odd thing that South Africa now has maybe top of the world rugby team and top of the world constitutional court, because the court's decisions are still being looked to. And, yeah, you know, the court is still, in a way, helping to hold this country together in terms of ensuring that the constitution that we fought so hard for, that Parliament spent 2 years creating with enormous investment, real passion of people who'd struggled under great hard conditions in the underground, resistance, exile, Robben Island, women's movement, labor movement, intellectuals, writers, artists, saying we want a constitution that's going to last. So that was like the voice of the people expressed in constitutional terms. And we have elections, and if the party loses, the governing party, it steps down. And if Parliament's not doing its work properly, the Constitutional Court says, naughty, 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 do it a little bit better next time. If the president is not upholding, it's always been constitutional duties, the court will speak out. So we have a very, very rich tradition. And for me, it was absolutely wonderful being on that first court with powerful colleagues of different backgrounds, personal beliefs, but all totally dedicated to upholding the fundamental rights in the Constitution.
And we're going to come back to all that delicious stuff in just a moment. Just two things. If we were to liken the judiciary, I guess, as a sporting team of the caliber of the Springboks, and you'd certainly rank amongst one of its MVPs, Judge. And I also can't believe that you're 90. That is amazing. And we can only aspire to have your good health, your vitality, and still that sense of contribution that you can still make in your 90s. So well done to you for that. I want to go back almost to the beginning. Well, not quite to the beginning, but your life and history are very much part of this conversation today, because we're creating the space where jurisprudence and aspiring legal minds can find out more about people like yourself sitting on the very first constitutional court bench in South Africa, people who shaped our laws and their careers, and how others can learn from it. So let's start with the early years. And your life and career are deeply intertwined with the country's struggle against apartheid. Tell me about your life in an activist and trade union household, and with particular reference to the influence of your dad, Emil.
Well, I'm actually going to put the emphasis more even on my mom. My dad, Solly Sachs, was the General Secretary of the Garment Workers Union, My mom and my dad split when I was very young, so I grew up in Cape Town with my little brother, single mom, support from my dad. He was a big figure out there. And my brother and I used to speak about our father, not daddy, our father. And people used to joke, our father, which art in heaven, you know. He's your daddy, come on. And he was a powerful, strong figure. He fought the bosses. He fought the state. He fought my mom. He fought his second wife. And he fought his children when he was older. He was also expansive and full of humor and very decided. And his family had fled from persecution of Jews in Lithuania. And he'd come as a youngster, put himself through school, in and out of school, working, organizing the union. He'd been in the Communist Party, been expelled from the Communist Party. My mom, Ray, was much quieter, very self-deprecating. And she would say to me and my little brother, tidy up, Uncle Moses is coming. And Uncle Moses wasn't Moses Cohen or Moses Cantor, it was Moses Kotani. And she was his typist. That was the term used in those days, not simply typist. So I grew up in a home where it was absolutely natural for my mother to have huge love and respect for her boss, who was a black man. That to me was normal. And the world outside was abnormal. So people say, what was it that brought you? What thing did you see, a black person being beaten up by the police, for not having you park, that got you into the struggle? I was born into the struggle. Even my name, Albert, Albie, I was named after Albert Nzula, who was a trade union leader, a communist, who died before I was born. At the age of six, when I was packing to go into exile, I found this little card. Dear Albert, on your sixth birthday, this is during World War II, may you grow up to be a soldier in the fight for liberation. Now, it's a little bit heavy for a six-year-old. But that theme of liberation and war, not being war of conquest, but war of liberation, was like instilled very early on. But I hated my parents, assuming I'd automatically follow in their footsteps. And it was only in my second year at the University of Cape Town. First year, I didn't even know who to vote for in elections, SRC election. Second year, I met a young crowd, my age, a little bit older than me. They were passionate. They were exciting. They were interactive. They argued about everything on earth. It was marvelous. And they were politically active. And I joined them. And I joined the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign age 17 as a second-year law student. And, you know, some people remember their first kiss. I don't know if you remember your first kiss. I don't remember my first kiss. I remember the first time I went to jail, you know, in the world I was growing up in. Those were the markers. Later on, when I went into exile, later on, a date when I was blown up, I hardly remember my birthday. When I came back to South Africa, all the big markers in my life were associated with huge drama. So anybody who's aspiring to be a judge, I'd say, you know, I did everything right. I got a PALOB, I got a PhD, I had a book, my PhD was published in England and United States. I practiced at the bar, Cape Town Bar, for nearly 10 years. I did everything right. I did everything wrong. I went to jail. I was blown up. Judges don't get blown up. That's not the ordinary, maybe somewhere in World War II or whatever it might be. I was in the resistance. I helped Chris Hani escape when he was my client out on bail after he'd been sentenced to jail. In that sense, I broke the law. Although I was a very, very, very correct advocate in terms of all the bar rules except one. That rule was, thou shalt accept a minimum fee for every piece of work you do. And most of my work I did for nothing. People charged under racist statutes. Just didn't want the bar to know. They would think I'm trying to collect clients by not charging. But these were people being sent to jail, threatened with jail, even execution, for resisting apartheid. I couldn't take a penny for that. I loved the law and I hated the law at the same time. I love the intellectual side. I love the possibilities of what you could do, maybe to trip up apartheid a little bit. I adored the process of constitution making, heavily involved there. You know, when I took the oath to uphold the apartheid constitution, I lied. I said, I'm going to faithfully uphold the constitution. I lied. But when I took the oath to uphold our new constitution, I felt so proud. And we took the oath in Setswana and isiZulu, Xhosa, English, Afrikaans. It was such a wonderful, wonderful day. South Africa now constituting its new court. Now, this constitution that helped heal South Africa, helped to heal Albie. Not my arm, I never got my arm back, but in the sense of no longer hating the law. And I often say, Iman, that, you know, we've got to be very skeptical about law's pretensions. Law under apartheid, it was law, ruled by law. It was vicious. It kept people apart. But although we are skeptical about law's pretensions, you should never be cynical about law's possibilities and what it can do and the emancipatory vision of law. And law, in particular, to defend the marginalized, the vulnerable, children, people subjected to sexual abuse or disadvantage on grounds of gender, people subjected to discrimination on grounds of who they happen to love. They happen to love somebody of their same gender. People who work deep down in the mines. The law doesn't stop at the entrance to the mine. It doesn't stop at the entrance to the farm. It doesn't stop at the entrance to the factory. It doesn't stop at the entrance to the home. So that kind of vision of the law that now is there available for the most vulnerable appealed to me enormously. And after decades of bringing down with apartheid, down with racism, down with this, it was wonderful to say, up with something else, to be healing, to be, you know, some of us in the struggle are so iconoclastic they can only go down with. And even afterwards, and they play a good role in our society, you need critics, even if they're over harsh at times. But some of us were dying to heal.
What do you have in mind, Albie, when you make that reference? Who are you thinking about?
Well, it came through very strongly to me when I was blown up and I'm recovering in London and I get a note from a comrade of mine in Mozambique, Bobby Naidu. His actual name is Sunny Singh. And he'd been on Robben Island for 10 years. And it came in the form of a letter. I don't know if you remember letters. We used to lick the envelope and put on stamps. And I opened it with my one hand. I'd lost the arm in the bomb put in my car by South African security agents in Mozambique. I'm recovering now. And says, "Don't worry, Comrade Albie, we will avenge you." And I think, avenge me? We're going to cut off the arm? We're going to blind in one eye? Is that what we're fighting for? If we get freedom in South Africa, if we get democracy, if we get the rule of law, that will be my soft vengeance. And that theme of soft vengeance became like the theme of my life. Roses and lilies will grow out of my arm. You don't do to them what they've done to you. Then you're just like them, but stronger. You transcend what they're doing. And you try and bring them in so that they change, that the country changes, because that makes sense. Yeah. It makes sense. I've lost my arm not because I was weaker than them and now I'm stronger and we can retaliate. I lost my arm because I voluntarily joined in a freedom struggle. And I won't say it's beautiful to lose an arm. I don't say everybody wanting to be a judge should be willing to risk yeah. their life and limb. But I'm saying that was part and parcel of the project. So getting the constitution was my soft vengeance. Getting the vote for everybody was my soft vengeance. Building the court on the site of the old Fort Prison, we say with a very dubious pride, we have the only jail in the world where both Gandhi and Mandela were locked up. Nobody can make that claim. And my colleague Teha Mosoneke says, and Robert Sobukwe, so I'm happy to add Robert Sobukwe as well, and Fatima yes. Mir and so many other people. That was soft vengeance. Working with the new constitution is soft vengeance. It's much more powerful than hard vengeance. Hard vengeance is never ending. It's filled with rage. It's just smiting those who were smiting us. Soft vengeance is moving into a different universe. A universe of idealism, of collegiality, of mutual respect. Today in South Africa, we'd say of Ubuntu, where Ubuntu is like writ large. It's wonderful, and it's very, very empowering. And none of these words enter into my, and the word Ubuntu does enter into my judgments, but they were part and parcel of the vision I had sitting up on the bench, a vision that is not based simply on rules, and having smart rules that say nice things, which you apply to people, But developing a legal technology, a vocabulary, a mode of storytelling, juridical storytelling, that people can acknowledge, recognize, identify with, feel connected. And it was absolutely wonderful to see how other judges could be inspired by sometimes a beautiful thought would come to me. I'm lying in the bath, not even working, lying in it, and a beautiful thought would come to me. And I'm a sharp person now, but I still remember those days getting out of the bath, and it's on capital punishment. It's on same-sex relationship. The word would just emerge, almost fully shaped, and end up in the judgment. And these were the phrases that traveled. They quoted later on in India and quoted in Canada, quoted or looked at in Kenya. Yeah,
I feel like, Albie, like those would, we need a little disclaimer at the bottom of those judgments saying, you know, conceived in a hot bathtub at your address as the addendum. There's so much in there. And this is why I've also allowed you to just continue to narrate, because it's such a beautiful narration. And I didn't know that you had romance in your heart as well, in the way that you formulate, you know, concepts, or that there was such a tenderness around how you viewed, you know, the concept of justice, which I, again, probably comes in quite strongly with the restorative justice theme. Let's go then to those judgments in court. I think you've dealt with, you know, the 60s and 66 in particular, where that attack happened, where, you know, you were living in Mozambique, or this was in 1988, sorry, in Mozambique, where you were that target of a car bomb attack by South African security agents and resulted in the losses that you have. But when you came back to South Africa, you were appointed by Nelson Mandela, then president, as one of the first judges of this brand spanking new constitutional court. And you've just shared with us how deliciously historic that is. But you have taken this human rights-centered approach to law, and some of your notable contributions I mentioned in the intro, same-sex marriage, the concept of restorative justice around freedom of expression, there were contributions made there, and also the importance of dignity, inclusion, and human rights in many of your rulings. Talk to us about the heaviness of the head that bears that crown, which is making these important decisions when it comes to people's lives, but also in the maturation of our legal framework.
Right. It wasn't a heavy head at all. And it wasn't wearing a crown. It was almost allowing the heart to come up into the head. So if it's pure heart, it's nothing. There's got to be structure. There's got to be organization. There's got to be predictability in law. But if it's only predictability in rules, and it's cold and sterile, and it's just in the head, it can be very anti-human. So the real tension, the core tension of judging, particularly in a top court like that, is dealing with values. The whole first third of the Constitution is a value system. Before the instruments of power, before Parliament, before the presidency, before even the judiciary, it's the value system, the preamble, the foundational values. The Bill of Rights. People all over the world look to these values. I wish I could say South Africa lived according to those values in every way. We don't. But it does set an example, and it does give those of us on the court it's the language, the spirit, the sense of history, the context in which to be able to make rulings that allow prisoners to vote, that abolishes capital punishment, the state cold-bloodedly killing one of its own, that upholds a law that prevents corporal punishment in schools, that, in my case, one of the judgments I wrote, enables homosexual people to express their love and accept their responsibilities in the same way that heterosexual people do. And it's not, in that sense, hard. What's hard, maybe, is to find language that reaches out to people who are shocked because of their culture, because of their religion, because of the traditions they've grown up in, to find a language to say, this is not beating you down. This is not a cultural war. This is respecting your views and your outlook, but it must coexist with the rights of others to be able to enjoy human dignity, which is the core of our whole constitutional project. And the poetic language, if you like, comes through spontaneously and naturally as the way to address the argument. It's the poetry of life. It's the poetry of humanity. It's not an invented, stilted poetry, A-B-A-B-A-C-D-D-E, rhyming schemes that you have to fit the law into. It's a poetry, if you like, of hope, but also a poetry of reason. And I found maybe I did make a special contribution to judgment writing in our court by starting off with a powerful statement. This case is about, instead of saying, we used to say the applicant in this case is a 54-year-old business person living in such and such a place. This happened, that happened, the other. I would try to get what is the heart of the issue to capture the attention of the reader from the beginning, and then also to end up. You've now done a magnificent judgment. You can't end up with some feeble little comment that somehow takes away the resonance. So sometimes my colleagues would say, Albie, we've got the judgment of the court. Will you do an Albie opening or will you do an Albie conclusion? And it wasn't inventing the theme. It was a certain, if you like, stylistic addition. And one of my colleagues spoke about me as being the poet of the court. It was a little bit backhanded to say, you know, they were the real technicians, and I was the one who would give it that little bit of allure and, if you like, glamour in the presentation. The glamour has to be rooted. It has to be centered. It mustn't look like a pastiche applied afterwards. It has to have reason. And many of my colleagues actually turned out to be very poetic. My late sister, Yvonne Mokgoro, wrote beautifully, and the theme of Ubuntu came naturally into her judgments. Maybe because she hadn't been to Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard. Later on, she went to Pennsylvania. Being a lawyer hadn't knocked out herself. She brought herself as a young African woman from Khanashere, working class background. She brought that spirit of justice onto the court with her. And she and I almost always agreed, yeah.
Yeah, Albie, I think that's so important because the standard, almost the gold standard, seems to be you've got to go outside of the country to show yourself approved and worthy in ours. So I love that you said that. I want to go to this before we completely run out of time, Albie. And this is the danger of having a really fantastic conversation, is that you don't realize how water is just, you know, evaporating with the same speed as it would through a colander. But I want to ask you about the courts as arbiters of justice, and we're in this frame of global justice, the cries of just for justice for people like the Palestinians, South Africa's moves in the ICJ, and we've seen developments in the ICC insofar as warrants of arrest for cabinet members in Netanyahu's cabinet, including himself and Yoav Gallant. Your thoughts on what it takes to use the courts as a means to promote and protect human rights, but in a meaningful way that actually can cause the silencing of the guns?
Well, on its own, it hasn't done that, but it's part and parcel of trying to stop the cannons, stop the bombs, stop the sniping, and engage. And for me, in a sense, it involves moving away from pure focus on survival. For us to survive, the enemy must die. There's no coexistence. To seeing every issue as existential, then your existence means crushing the existence of another. To move away from that to coexistence, and coexistence allows for law. And how can we prosper and they prosper at the same time? So, for example, in relation to Palestine-Israel, for me, the only security for Israel is a strong Palestine, not a weak Palestine. I heard a Palestinian family living in Israel visit at my home recently in Cape Town, and the husband said, what we want is one homeland, two countries. But I thought that's not enough. It's got to be one homeland, two countries, shared interests and mutual respect. And that's the only way the wars will come to an end. And it seems impossible, but South Africa seemed impossible. And we pulled it off in South Africa. We haven't accomplished the equal society that we want. But it seemed impossible. Either the whites remain in control, or the blacks take over and the whites are told footsack. And it didn't end up that way. And I believe the same can happen. Just to say two states is not enough in itself. It's got to be two strong states, and Palestinians must get the same sense of pride and identity and meaning from having a Palestinian state that Jews claim they've got from having a Jewish state, Israel. And for me, that's got to be the end goal. And to get there, the law is going to have to play a huge role at different stages, from ceasefire to negotiations to working out some forms of arrangement whereby through mutual interest in the Holy Land, through mutual interest in trade, through mutual interest in sharing stories and history and science and tourism, then the peoples of Israel and Palestine can live together in equality. I'd just like to add, I was so proud of the advocacy, independently of the actual arguments, of the two former law clerks as part of the great South African team. And that was Adila Hasim and Tembeka Mnuke Tobi. I felt, wow, you know, what a court that produced products of such style and poise and thoughtfulness and humanity.
Wow, that's just, there's so much to reflect on. There's so much to be proud of. If I had a glass, Albie, I would raise it to you. We know that you've won awards. There are accolades aplenty. You continue to make that impact. For those who are listening to our conversation today, thinking, you know, should I consider a career in law? Would you say go for it? Or what would your words of advice be?
I would say definitely go for it. Partly law is so, we use a funny legal word called fungible. It adapts to so many different situations. And if you want to be somebody who just sells houses and gets nice contracts and everybody be secure, you never argue in court, you don't have any emotion, you just check that all the details are there, you can do it. If you want to stand up in court and orate and persuade judges and fight for justice, you can do that. If you want to use your knowledge to make money, it's a huge help. You can combine money making with law. If you want to gouge money back from wealthy people and protect the poor, you can do that through law. And you can do that through public interest law. You can do that through working for government agencies connected with prosecuting crooks. And you can work that through public insurance, a whole different range of areas. So in that sense, it allows for almost every kind of personality and every kind of ambition. So I would argue in favor of it. I should admit, however, I tried to escape from law. When I went into exile, often 10 years at the bar in Cape Town, I thought, okay, great. Now, I've been there, done that. But I ended up a law teacher in England and a law teacher in Mozambique. I thought, okay, I'm coming back to South Africa. I can get out of law. I was a law professor at UWC, and I wasn't going to be a lawyer. It was, April. It was March 1994, and I'm feeling very uneasy. What's going on here? The big moment of our life, we're going to vote as equals for the first time, and I'm feeling very uncomfortable, and I realize what's going on. There are four members of the Constitutional Committee on the National Executive of the ANC. Is going to be one Minister of Justice. Would it be Kader Asmal? Would it be Zola Skweer? Would it be Dalla Omar? Or would it be Albie Sachs? I thought, oh, no. I haven't spent my life wondering, will the phone ring? It was like that was going to destroy all my idealism. I'm getting out of politics, been there, done that, made my contribution, and I'm going to get out of law this time unless I'm put on the Constitutional Court. I don't want to practice as a lawyer. I don't want to teach law anymore. I was actually going to make films. I had a film in my head. Well, I got onto the Constitutional Court. So I ended up 15 wonderful years on that court. Very enriching for me, marvelous colleagues. And it was a continuation of my life. I was like in a bubble created by the Constitution. So I'm less cynical. I'm less worn out than my colleagues who carried on with the political life, who got gouged, who got tempted, who had to struggle against evil inside their own ranks. I didn't go through all that. I'm able to maintain a certain, if you like, pure idealism, sitting as the person, as part of the team, upholding the values for which we've been fighting. So I'm still there.
Albie, that's such a gorgeous way for us to bring this conversation to an end. There's so many themes that we can talk about. Your legal practice, your detention as an anti-apartheid lawyer, twice detained, by the way, by the apartheid government without trial, then in solitary confinement. We can even talk about, you know, the contributions, more contributions you made on the Concord. We can talk about the fact that you're a writer, that you are a lecturer, that you've won awards and honors. We just started out our conversation talking about the Albies. But I think this is a beautiful teaser as well for others to go and read up a little bit more on your legendary life. Long may it continue, Albie, to continued success and vitality. And thank you again I'm going to be presumptuous and say on behalf of all South Africans for your immense contribution to the judiciary and to law and to freedom in South Africa.
Thank you, Iman.
You've been listening to Legal Luminaries, a Jackpod original podcast by Duta and Jacaranda FM. I'm Iman Rapetti. Find more episodes at jacarandafm.com. Just click on Jackpod.